from Ferndale, Michigan. That's lead man Ron Carter on bass with All Blues, recorded on October the 24th, 1973. Sir Roland Hanna on piano, Joe Henderson on tenor sax, and Billy Cobham on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and today we return to a story that we actually began in 2014, when we sounded the alarm here on this particular program about a water crisis and a massive public health catastrophe that were unfolding in Detroit and Flint, Michigan. It is only now grabbing national headlines and gaining national attention, and for reasons that we will explain here. It is no longer just, quote, a black problem, unquote. In Detroit, still reeling from severe austerity measures imposed after the city's forced 2013 bankruptcy, water shutoffs continue unabated for thousands of homeowners too poor to pay. About 80,000 are behind in their water bills. That's the crisis in Detroit that continues. But in Flint, tens of thousands of people have been exposed to lead-poisoned and bacteria-infected water after the cash-strapped city, now under emergency management as Detroit was, switched its water supply from Detroit and instead is drawing water from the extremely polluted Flint River. Our first guest is Kurt Guyette, the person who sounded the alarm, an investigative reporter for the ACLU of Michigan, and he broke the story about Flint. He returns to us today to give us a comprehensive update. Kurt, great to have you with us today.
Well, it's very nice to be back, and you deserve credit for recognizing this, the importance of this story before most others in the media did.
Well, thank you. Let's talk about what's happened. Could you give us a little background so people can appreciate the enormity of the story that you broke and the impact that is only now beginning to be felt?
Yes, well, so the under control of a state-appointed emergency manager who, under this really very extreme Michigan law, has unchecked power, and the local duly elected officials have really no authority, the state decided to, in order to save money, switch from the Detroit system, which had been providing clean, safe water to Flint for 50 years, and begin using the very polluted and dangerously corrosive Flint River as the city's water source. As soon as the switchover occurred, people knew that the water was no good. It smelled bad, it looked bad, and it tasted bad. And pretty quickly, they started to have all sorts of different health problems. Hair began falling out in clumps. Rashes developed. All sorts of, you know, strange maladies began to crop up. Then there was problems with E. coli in the water, because really Flint was not prepared to deal with the complexity of treating the river water. In response to the E. coli, they increased the amount of chlorine they were applying. The increased chlorine led to the formation of a carcinogenic byproduct called total trihalomethanes. People were exposed to that for 9 months before the city told them what was going on. That came to light in January. In February, after lead tests in the water going into one home showed levels, you know, seven times above the federal EPA action level, those results were turned over to the EPA. They began sending emails to Michigan's Department of Environmental Quality, one saying this looks like it's a real problem, began asking questions about corrosion control, because one of the issues is that the Flint River is about at least five times more corrosive than the Detroit water. And Detroit used phosphates, which are a corrosion control material. Flint, under the direction of the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, inexplicably, at a time when they went to a water source that was many times more corrosive, stopped using corrosion control. And that resulted in the tearing apart of the pipes and causing lead to leach into the water. And so the MDEQ knew that this was an issue certainly no later than February of 2015. As time went on, there was one of the residents, a mom named Leanne Walters, took her kid to a doctor, found out that one of her children had been lead poisoned. She became determined to get to the bottom of it. She found a incredible guy at the EPA named Miguel Del Toro, who took an interest in her case, came to Flint, made sure that there was no lead sources within her house, then arranged for Professor Mark Edwards from Virginia Tech, a MacArthur Genius Grant recipient who had uncovered the lead problem in Washington, D.C.'s water in the early 2000s. They did a thorough independent test of the Walters water, found levels exceeding 2.5 times what it takes to be classified as hazardous waste. When that happened, the state's response was to say that the Walters family was an anomaly, that there was no widespread lead problem in Flint, and, quote, people there should just relax. At that point, we were involved after Del Toro wrote a memo, internal memo, that outlined the science behind the problem and saying why it was almost certainly a widespread problem, in order to prevent that from just ending up in the bureaucracy and getting covered over. He gave a copy to Ms. Walters, who shared it with us. We published it, and that's when the state said, you know, this is not an issue. At that point, the question became, how do we get to the truth? And the answer was that there was a collaboration between Mark Edwards and his team at Virginia Tech. He received a National Science Foundation grant to pay for the testing of 300 homes in Flint. A small group of residents that were part of a group called the Coalition for Clean Water, working in conjunction with the ACLU of Michigan. We did our own test of the water. In a little over 2 weeks, we tested four times as many homes as the city tested in the previous 6 months. And we proved conclusively that the lead levels were far higher than what the city and state were claiming. My investigation also showed how the state was and city were essentially cheating on the test, skewing it so they came in lower than the actual results were, and that explained the discrepancy between their results and Virginia Tech's results, which showed that it was far above the federal action level. Again, the state denied that there was a problem, began to focus attention on aging infrastructure. What happened next was that because of the Virginia Tech results were so alarming, another courageous person, Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha, a pediatrician at Flint's Hurley Children's Hospital, conducted her own study where she looked at the lead levels in the blood of children before and after the switch to the river, and found that after the switch, the percentage of children with elevated levels of lead in their blood doubled, and in areas where Virginia Tech found the highest levels in the water, kids were, their blood levels like tripled. And so, again, more proof of the problem of lead in the water as a result of using the river. And, again, the state attacked the credibility of Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha until finally one of the local newspapers analyzed the state's data independently and said, guess what? You're contrary to what you're claiming, state of Michigan, your data actually confirms what Dr. Hanna-Attisha found. And that was really the game changer. At that point, they could no longer deny that there was a problem with lead, but they kept trying to deny that the problem was with the river until finally a panel of experts, independent experts, that had been appointed by city officials recommended that in order to protect the health and well-being of the residents of Flint, the city be allowed by the governor to switch back to the Detroit system, which happened at the end of October. Since then, it's been, you know, there's been a whole series of actions, but that sort of brings us up to that point. I don't want this to just be a long monologue, but if you want, you know, go ahead and ask me another question if you would like.
No, I would like you to just do what you're doing. Give us a comprehensive overview.
Okay, fine. Well, so the governor, when he announced that Flint would be allowed to return to the Detroit system, made a statement, there's no need to affix blame here. That doesn't do any good. We'll do an after-action report to see what problems might have occurred so we make sure that they don't occur going forward. But, you know, the governor's, one of his taglines is, you know, he pursues relentless positive action. And he kept, you know, sort of pushing that point, saying, you know, the thing to do now is not to assign blame. It's to get to work and correct whatever problems there are and make sure that this problem doesn't happen again.
But Kurt, this problem, when it started out, when you first got involved, this goes back to 2014, it was very clear because the ACLU made it very clear. There was also a racial aspect to this. Could you talk about why, or if you believe, as the ACLU did, that there was, in fact, a racial aspect to this case being ignored for as long as it was ignored and denied for as long as it was denied?
Well, there's a couple of things. One is that the emergency manager law, as it's been applied, has focused on cities where that have majority African American populations. The cities that have lost democracy have been African American cities, and it's a race issue. And it's also a class issue, because they're poor cities, and that Flint, for instance, has a 40% of the population lives below the poverty line. So there's both of those aspects. But the other thing is that, and this goes back to the emergency manager law, and one of the flaws that has been tragically exposed in Flint is, along with taking away the usual democratic representation that everybody in America takes for granted, is it creates inherent lack of checks and balances. In the case of Flint, it was the state, with an emergency manager in place, making the decision to use the river in a purely cost-cutting manner because, you know, these people, it didn't matter what the quality of the water was. What mattered was whether they balanced the budget or not. So people's health was put at risk in order to save money. And then the department that is supposed to be making sure that the testing is done correctly is also run by a gubernatorial appointee. So there's no independent actors here. Everything is emanating from the governor's office. And so the lack of checks and balances allowed the the skewed testing to go on and actually was encouraged by the state. And so certainly the racial factor and the class factor are a very big part of this. And, you know, in terms of politics, there's not a lot of Republican votes up in Flint. And so the governor and his party doesn't have to worry about, you know, losing votes in a city where they don't get votes anyhow. So if there's a political calculation going on, that's certainly part of the equation. So those are all factors there, without a doubt.
And here we now have this catastrophe that has been allowed to mushroom with indifference from the government and denial, plain denial and lies and deception on the part of the government. And it is now said to be on the order of Katrina in terms of impact. Could you talk about what the impact has been in terms of the number of people who have been affected or infected by this dirty, toxic water?
Well, Flint has 100,000 people, and it's actually, at this point, very difficult to know how many of them are suffering the consequences of the exposure to lead, which is harmful in many, many ways, particularly to children who will suffer lower IQs, learning disabilities, behavioral problems as result of exposure to elevated levels of lead. Adults also experience a number of problems. But one of the things is that lead dissipates from the blood very quickly. And so if you stopped drinking the water a couple months ago and you just now go in to get a blood test, it's not going to show up. And so it's very difficult to put an exact number on how many people have been affected by this. But certainly, you know, you have a city of 100,000, and everybody with a lead service line, there's 15,000 lead service lines at the very minimum in Flint. They're all put in danger. People with lead plumbing are all being put in danger because of this. You know, along with the costs of the increased costs of having to educate these children with disabilities, you have massive amount of infrastructure. The newly elected mayor, Karen Weaver, has estimated that might be $1.5 billion. You have property values, which have dropped dramatically because you can't even sell a house in Flint now. Who wants to move to a city that has poisoned water? You know, and so that's one of the consequences of this. You have people whose, you know, hot water heaters and dishwashers and, you know, all sorts of internal plumbing that has been ravaged by this highly corrosive water. So the initial estimate was that the city was going to save $5 million by switching to the river while this new water source, this Karagandhi pipeline, was being built and is supposed to be completed sometime this year. So you look at it, and for a projected saving of $5 million, you really cannot calculate the actual monetary damage done, but it could easily, you know, it's already $1.5 billion in terms of just the infrastructure. To say it's going to be billions is not a stretch at all. You have the National Guard deployed now, passing out water to people. You have the expense of deploying the National Guard. But then, beyond that, you have the cost that can never be calculated. How, you know, the trauma that it's you know, put on people to live under this, to be told by your government that the water was safe when it wasn't. What that does to a person's psyche. The guilt of parents who think, you know, I should have realized something was wrong. You know, that's just heartrending to hear about that. So all this austerity, there's no more dramatic example of how terribly wrong things could go when the goal is austerity above all else. It's you know, unfortunately, well, for the people of Flint, they're the proof of that.
Well, certainly the response has been also offensive. I mean, when the President of the United States decides that this is, in fact, a catastrophe, a major crisis here, a state of emergency, and could only come up with $5 million to address a problem that you just talked about that would cost billions of dollars to correct, that is offensive. And we still have no clue, really, from the governor, who is supposed to be making his State of the State address tonight. You said you're going to go. What are you expecting him to say? And what do you think of the president's generosity under these circumstances of $5 million to correct what he considers to be a major crisis?
Well, I think in some ways the president's hands might be tied because the law under which the most funds are available are for natural disasters. This was a man-made disaster, so it's not like Katrina. You know, there were certainly things that happened in Katrina that contributed, decisions that were made that contributed to the disaster there, but it was a hurricane that was the root of the issue. Here, the root of the issue was something that could have been and should have been avoided, but was not. And so there's a difference between a natural disaster and a man-made disaster, which...
Yeah, but the response to the World Trade Center bombing was in accordance with what anybody would consider to be a crisis or a disaster. That was not natural.
Yeah.
That was a man-made disaster.
Yeah,
and
the
nation
arguing,
responded appropriately.
Right.
So
I'm not arguing that more isn't needed. I'm just trying to explain, you know, some of what's going on, at least as best as my understanding is, which I don't know as much about that aspect, honestly, as I do, because I'm still been intent on focusing on investigating what's gone on here. But so I'm not trying to justify it. I'm just saying, you know, what
I understand the circumstances
to be.
Now, what are you looking for? Have you gotten the answers to the typical questions of what did the governor know and when did he know it and what did he do with what he learned?
Yeah, you know, he's been pretty slippery on this and using semantics, but clearly the state knew in February of 15 at the latest that this was an issue. And actually, the Department of Health and Human Services, their own data shows a significant spike in the blood level of children in the months after the switch in 2014. So you could argue that action should have been taken as early as the summer of 2014. But so we have a lot of good information about what the state knew. But here's what we don't have an answer to yet, which is, I did an interview with the former director of public works in Flint, who said on the record that the decision to switch to the river in the first place came out of the governor's office. And the governor still has not given a clear, direct, unequivocal answer to what is a yes or no question. Did your office play a role in the decision-making process that led to the use of the river in the first place? He won't answer that. As a matter of fact, when they're asked that, they tend to respond by telling things that aren't true. We didn't have a choice. Detroit kicked us off the system. Not true. That wasn't our decision. The Flint City Council voted to begin using the river. Not true. So when you answer a direct question with untruths, you got to think that there is a good reason for them, especially when what they're saying can provably easily be proven to be false, which has turned out to be the case. They keep trying to defend themselves by saying things that are easily proven to be not true. And so there could well be very good reason that they're not given honest answers to this, is because the truth is something that they don't want to bear. So the other question then is, why did no one at any place along the line before this decision was made say, look, this water's too corrosive, we can't use it? It's because Mark Edwards from Virginia Tech said anybody with even rudimentary knowledge of the science behind this could have easily predicted that disaster would occur if you began using this river water the way that you did. And so those are two questions that the governor, who keeps saying that he wants to reestablish trust with the people of Flint and that he wants to be open about this process, he's not being open, and he's not doing anything to reestablish trust by ducking those questions as he has so far.
Well, there is a groundswell of outcry that the governor should resign. He has said he will not. Do you expect that those cries would grow louder?
Well, it depends on what happens. Right now, the governor appointed a task force to look into the crisis. They turned over their initial findings on December 29th, singling out the Department of Environmental Quality for its actions and inactions in regard to this, especially noting how, as was sort of evident in my little quick summary, their whole tone and approach was to attack people who were proved to be telling the truth. They were more intent on attacking truth tellers than they were doing their job of providing adequate oversight. So both the head of the Department of Environmental Quality and his chief spokesman have resigned as a result of this. But again, we get back to what was the governor's role and his office's role in the decision to do this in the first place. And I think that in addition to the task force, the state attorney general has launched an investigation, and the state or the U.S. Department of Justice, in conjunction with the U.S. EPA, has launched an investigation, although honestly the EPA has been shameful in their handling of this crisis as well. And so there's not great confidence in some ways when you have the agency investigating itself, but at least the Justice Department is on it. And so, you know, there's three separate investigations going on. I think there should be a fourth. I think the legislature should open an investigation and put people under oath answering questions in public. I think that is very necessary thing to do, because there have been a lot of lies, frankly, offered so far, a lot of sleazy, weaselly ways to try to get around giving direct answers to just direct questions, a lot of obfuscation, and so people need to be put under oath. And if they're going to keep saying that same kind of stuff, then let them face perjury charges, or finally tell the full truth about what's going on. Unfortunately, we have a Republican-controlled legislature here, and so they're not very eager to do the right moral thing here and to do their job and not to look out for their party's interests, but to look out for the best interests of everybody in the state of Michigan and launch an open investigation into this as well.
Well, you've done so much, Kurt, to bring this story to the public's attention, and you are continuing to follow the story, and I hope that we will be joined by you again very shortly when you have some further details to share with us. But I want to thank you so much for the work that you've been doing, and certainly for being with us today to provide this comprehensive update.
Thank you very much. If I could just say one other thing.
Sure.
In all the tragedy of this, there is something very heartening, which is that this truth, you know, I'm doing my job, but this would have never been exposed were it not first and foremost because of a group of Flint residents who refused to believe the lies that their government was telling them and would not rest until they saw the truth exposed. So were it not for them, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you right now, and the whole world would not know about this tragedy that occurred in Flint. And so the credit goes to the residents of Flint, and democracy might have been taken away from them, but they did not lie down and take it. They're fighters up there in Flint, and that's exactly what they did. They fought back, and they're still fighting back.
Thank you. Thanks for being with us today.
You're very welcome.
And this gives us a wonderful transition to a subject that should be familiar to those of you listening to Lead Stories regularly, and that is the city of Detroit. The problem unfolding in Flint, the problem that has dealt such a wallop to thousands and tens of thousands of people in that city, in that majority African-American city, were begun, if you will, they started out in nearby Detroit. And, of course, we will have an explanation of the connection here. And the connection is the imposition of an emergency manager in both cities. Abba Yomi Ezekiwe, a very familiar voice here on Lead Stories. He is our correspondent in Detroit. He has coursed us for about 2 years on the forced bankruptcy of Detroit and its aftermath, and he joins us again. He is the editor-in-chief of the Pan-African Newswire, and he's an organizer in Detroit for the Workers' World Party. Abba Yomi, great to have you with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Well, we just finished talking with Kurt Guyette, who is reporting on the situation in Flint. But I see the common thread here being the question of these the state's approach to governing, which is to remove any semblance of decision-making from the local people. And key to that is the imposition of the emergency manager. Could you tell us whether, in your view, you see it the same way?
I do. And there's a clear connection between Detroit and Flint on a myriad of levels. Both are, you know, highly industrialized cities. They were built as a result of the automotive sector of the economy. And most recently, they both have fallen under the travails of emergency management in this aftermath. And there's still emergency management because you have the state financial review board that really makes the decisions in Detroit in terms of how money is supposed to be spent, strategic plans that are developed, how the residents are viewed in relationship to the banks and the corporations. But there's another link, and that is that Darnell Early, who was the emergency manager in Flint, between October of 2013 and January of 2015, was in power, at least ostensibly, when a decision was made to break off the Flint public water system from the Detroit Water and Sewage Department and link it up with a previous system where they got water that was polluted from the Flint River. And Early now is the emergency manager over the Detroit Public Schools. And I'm sure you've heard from Elena Harada and others, the deplorable conditions that are prevailing now in the Detroit public schools. There have been sick outs in over 60 schools. You're talking about two-thirds of the population of schools, students, as well as faculty and other employees, over the last several weeks have engaged in wildcat strikes, which they call sick outs, where they don't show up at work. So this is a product of the denial of basic democratic rights, of placing corporations and financial institutions as the primary administrators and recipients of benefits from public service, whether it's in the education field or whether it's in the municipal area.
Now, the city of Detroit has not let up on the water shutoffs to people who can't afford to pay. As a matter of fact, I was reading a document that was filed jointly by the NAACP and the ACLU saying that although nationally it's accepted that a water bill should not exceed 2.5% of the median household income, in Detroit, the water bill exceeds 20% of the median income. Is there any doubt in your mind about the racial aspect here in both Flint and in Detroit as to the attitude of the government and the abysmal way in which citizens' rights have just been abrogated and just people have just been trounced with impunity?
I believe so, because both are majority African-American cities, and they can utilize racism that's fostered among the majority white population to say that these problems, they may not come out directly and say it. They'll say that they result from the mismanagement, the inherent corruption and ineptitude of African-American politicians. You know, we've seen the same, we've heard the same argument since the days of Reconstruction. I mean, it was a rationale that was utilized by the Southern planters and their descendants to deny African-Americans the right to vote and citizenship that was ostensibly guaranteed in the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment, the Civil Rights Acts of 1866, 1870, 1875. And all of that was taken away on the false claims that African Americans cannot conduct public or municipal affairs. And it's a similar argument, although they may take the racial categorization or characterization out of it. But it, in effect, it's the same thing, that somehow these wealthy white men, like Governor Rick Snyder, who's a venture capitalist, somehow they know better than others how to run a city or how to run a water system or an educational system. And this really, what's happened, as horrible as it is, the positive aspect of it is that it exposes the falsity and the fallacies of those arguments, that these people do not know how to run a school system. They know how to run it into the ground. They know how to run cities into the ground. They know how to disenfranchise and expropriate working people and oppress people. But in terms of rebuilding a city and reshaping the way it operates so it can be effective for the majority of the people who live in it, that is not their agenda.
Could you talk about what's going on with the water shutoffs? So we have the shutting off of water in Detroit, and we have polluted water in Flint. What's happening in other majority black cities that are now suffering under the direction of emergency managers?
If we look at it from a broader perspective, there are large-scale corporations and banks that have the objective of privatizing all water resources in the world. And with Michigan having such a large percentage of fresh water reserves, we're a prime target, you know, for these economic institutions. And it's outrageous that in Flint, people are still being billed for poisonous water. They're still getting shutoff notices for poisonous water. In Detroit, even though they've turned over more than a half a billion dollars to banks as termination fees on fraudulent interest rate swaps and other forms of bond transactions, they are not investing the necessary resources to rebuild the monumental infrastructure of the Detroit Water and Sewage Department that now is slated to become Great Lakes Regional Water Authority. in our view, in an attempt to eventually privatize the water system, at least the management of it, in southeastern Michigan and throughout the state of Michigan as a whole. We see this same pattern taking place in other cities, like in Inkster, for example, which is a suburb of Detroit next to Dearborn, that historically, you know, had been a residential area for African Americans under the old early Ford Motor Company management model. Their entire public school system was liquidated, so all the students there have to go to school in other surrounding districts. We can look at the situation that's going on in Highland Park, which is like a subsection independent municipality in Detroit, where they've also liquidated the public school system after years of emergency management, where there's large-scale blight, and where they are subjected to outside control. Their water system also has undergone various forms of restructuring. And now the Detroit Water and Sewage Department is claiming that they owe, Highland Park owes Detroit hundreds of millions of dollars. For years, the people who live in Highland Park never received water bills. And then when they did receive water bills, they were in the thousands of dollars. So this is the type of absolute, you know, managed chaos that's going on. And in effect, you know, it drives a lot of people out of these areas. Because it's very difficult to stay in a situation where even the water bills, in many cases, is difficult to determine what you're actually being charged for. And the fact that there's thousands upon, actually tens of thousands of abandoned structures in the city, and in many of those structures, pipes are broken, water has been running for months and for years. So the people who live in the city, who do business in the city, particularly small and medium-sized business, have to absorb that cost. Now, the wealthier people came out, it was in 2014, a lot of them have huge water bills, and they don't get shut off. So this shows how these cities are structured to benefit the rich, the 1%.
As you say this, this is a point that Kurt Guyatt made. He said that in Flint, what is emerging now is a conjoining between race and class in opposition to what is going on under emergency management. Do you think that this is what, in fact, is happening?
Yes, and I really want to condemn what they have done, Snyder, and the fact that they refuse to accept responsibility. But then I want to commend Kurt Guyatt for the work that he has done on this issue, because I remember he worked for many years for the Metro Times in Detroit, and then he went with the Michigan ACLU, which has given him tremendous professional freedom, you know, to be creative and to really do some serious investigative journalism, which you don't really see a lot of in 2016. Where you can really find out, you know, the root causes of the problem and start making connections. For example, this outbreak of Legionnaires' disease is being linked in regard to, you know, just preliminary findings to the Flint water crisis. So, you know, Snyder has to be held accountable. His consultants who advised him to do this have to be held accountable. And they need to be held criminally liable. And the people in Flint need to be paid large-scale reparations. It's just not enough to fire him or have him resign or even to prosecute him. We're looking at billions, perhaps, of dollars to repair the system. They're going to have to put in new pipes. They're going to have to build even broader infrastructure. They're going to have to hire specialists, water chemists, engineers. It's a monumental task. And for the president to say, oh, it's an emergency, but then at the same time, they're not treating it as an actual federal emergency. I think it's quite empty. I mean, to say he's going to send $5 million, I mean, what are they going to do? You know, take $5 million and buy more bottles of water? You know, passing out bottled water is not the solution to this crisis, even in the short term. What about people who don't have cars? What about people who are living with disabilities or senior citizens who can't get around, people who are ill? How do they get access even to that bottled water? And how far is the bottled water going to go? It's just not being treated, in my opinion, given the priority that it should be given.
When we started talking about the bankruptcy, the forced bankruptcy of Detroit, I repeatedly said that we should pay attention to Detroit because it is a template for what is about to happen all across the United States. Given this situation now spreading to Flint, to Inkster, to many other places, cities in Michigan that are predominantly African American, do you believe, in fact, that this is what is happening, that it is, in fact, a template?
I really do, because we've seen in other cities, in Chicago, with the revelations about all these police killings and how they were covered up, the videos were not released, and Rahm Emanuel is refusing to step down as well. And, of course, the school crisis in Chicago, where they closed well over 50 educational buildings. Teachers are in an uproar, just like they are here in the city of Detroit, because of the deplorable conditions under which they have to work. And these professionals, they're educating future generations of the majority of people in society. I mean, the poor and the working class people in the United States are the majority. And if they are not being properly educated, then what is that going to say about the future in the short term, in another 15, 20 years? If people are not prepared to address the challenges of the world. In New York, we can see with the explosion in homelessness there, which has even been reported on in the New York Times about how the homeless problem in New York is worse than it's ever been in history, which is almost even worse than it was in the 1980s, and which is almost unbelievable. This is what is happening in the urban areas, and the wealthy people are only concerned about acquiring more wealth, most of them. And apparently, if we look and see what's been happening on Wall Street just this year, that doesn't appear to be sustainable either. They claim that they've lost over $1.2 trillion in the stock markets in the first 2.5 weeks of this year. So sooner or later, a lot of this is really going to come to the fore.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us today, Abayomi, and for bringing us up to speed. We still have more to tell, perhaps in a not too distant future, about what's going on with Detroit as it emerges from its forced, absolutely forced bankruptcy. Thanks so much for being with us and giving us this update.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thanks. Well, that brings us to the end of the program today. A sobering look at how things are done that look very, again, they look very unconnected. But we see that, in fact, they are. And we see also a system proceeding with its plan, which includes the denial of what people usually call your constitutional rights. Those rights just do not apply here. But the victimization and the absolutely vapid response by people who can make a difference, like Barack Obama, like the members of the Congressional Black Caucus, the most senior member coming from Detroit, John Conyers. And we see all the more the need for an issue that has arisen here on this program, the need for a people's attorney general. There is no legal challenge here in behalf of the people to speak of. The ACLU, to its credit, the NAACP in Detroit, to its credit, has taken on this issue of advocacy. But I'm talking brutal, bruising legal battles. We don't have that. And that's something to keep in mind. I thank you for joining me and for listening. I encourage you to pass the word about PRN to those in your circle. Coming up next, Infectious Myth with David Crow. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Let me know how you are reacting to these stories that we present every day. More tomorrow, and until then, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Thanks for joining me today.